Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
That almost sounded like an NPR program intro.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Today at Huffington
Post. So that happened.
So that happened. This week, as America's service sector workers continue their fight for 15, the rallying cry for an increase in the minimum wage, we'll take a look at one small community and one business in particular in which the battle for a $15 minimum wage has been won. Now the experiences of these workers and their boss offer insight into how a rise in the minimum wage might play out elsewhere. Meanwhile, the battle over the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal is getting more and more intense and sowing new and interesting divisions between nominal ideological allies. What is it about this trade deal that has people so rankled? We shall endeavor to explain. Finally, how do you solve a problem like a presidential election that's happening way too early and being way too stupid? You don't. No, the problem, it can't be solved. I'm sorry. That's just life. We all live in a world of garbage. However, you can still futilely lash out at your tormentors, so why don't you join us for a round of that? I'm Jason Linkins with the Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Dave Jamieson, and here's what happened first. Hi, welcome to So That Happened. It is a podcast at the Huffington Post here in Washington, D.C. I'm Jason Linkins, the editor of Eat the Press. Today, I have with me my friends, starting with
Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter for also the Huffington Post.
Yes, and also
Dave Jamieson, labor reporter at Huffington Post. Not as interesting a title as Zach's, but
pretty interesting.
It's a title. We'll take it.
It wasn't made up just to make you happy when they denied your raise.
Like, it literally describes what you do.
Like, that's true.
And you are a labor reporter. It's not just that your reporting is labored.
That is correct.
Okay, good. And congratulations, new homeowner.
Thank you.
That's
awesome. Thank you very much.
That's awesome. And once again, we've conspired to do an all University of Virginia podcast today. So,
And with landed elites now as well.
Right, super landed. We are the gentry now, apparently. Right, exactly as Thomas Jefferson wanted. Sorry to all other universities.
Not being as good.
We don't mean to be an insular crowd today. So how's everyone been?
Great.
Yeah, you got a house now.
Got a house. Was in Seattle last week. Never been to Seattle. Great town.
Yeah. Do you regret not having your house in Seattle now?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Actually.
Bound to happen.
Yeah.
Rains a lot there, though, which, you know, if you're like me, when I was at UVA, for instance, I didn't go to class if it rained. So I don't know how I would be able to survive a working life at a place like Seattle.
It was so weird. When I lived in Charlottesville, it seemed like the rain would roll in Friday night and, like, leave Sunday. It was like, yeah, fuck your weekend, said the rain.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yep.
It was like, strange and uncanny. I was always looking forward to going out, and instead I was wet.
That happens.
Instead I was wet. I regretted the wetness, the dampness.
That was sort of my week. It was a lot of rain. I felt like, you know, news-wise, it's really been dominated by the TPP talk, so I just haven't had really time to come up for air. It's just been constantly raining down on me.
We're going to talk some TPT today, but let's just start. Just want to briefly mention today, President Obama made a statement. Apparently a drone strike went wrong.
Oof.
For the first time ever. apparently. Actually, it's not the first time a drone strike has gone wrong. Obviously, we've been killing innocent civilians with drones for quite some time. But today, unfortunately, it came to light that a couple of white Westerners were killed. So that's different. Not to diminish them at all. Dr. Warren Weinstein, an American aid worker and Giovanni Laporto, an Italian aid worker, both killed in a drone strike. Obama was teased by a note from the press office, and then he went in front of cameras today and said, you know, I take full responsibility for this. So that's like a start, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this has always been the issue with the drone program, right? Is that, I mean, they used to have, I think I remember you making fun of this, actually. They have like a Terror Tuesdays meeting between Obama and top intelligence officials where yes. they talk about who's going to be droned like it's
right.
a taco special.
They have a kill list. It's like, you know, you go to a small plates restaurant and order, and it's like, I'll take this guy. Blast him out of existence. War can go wrong, but what's oddly strange about the drone side of the war is that there seems to be an enormous amount of pretense given to the fact that it's like perfect clinical and that things rarely go wrong. The very first drone strike, I believe, killed that in the Obama administration killed 14 innocent civilians, and we now tend to like sort of see them as sort of blank. You know, collateral damage. We now tend to call everyone in these regions militants. We downgrade terrorists to militants, and we upgrade ordinary citizens that are of military age to militants, you know.
Now, at one point, the definition was just like any male over the age of like 15
right.
was considered a potential combatant, right? And that was kind of a loose definition, to say the least.
Pretty great. I mean, it's like the worst bar mitzvah ever. It's like, you've become a man. Now you can be killed by a drone strike and people won't feel bad.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the issue, though, is that the administration always portrays drone strikes, as you said, as something surgical. The alternative to these surgical drone strikes is boots-on-the-ground war, which would be very messy and very complicated. So by contrast, this only kind of messy targeted killing is easier, and I think that message actually like resonates with a lot of the American people, which is why I don't think you've seen as much outrage within the Democratic Party as you've seen as you saw in the anti-war movement against George W. Bush. But people still get killed, and there's still people.
Yep, it's true.
Sad. It's very sad.
Well, let's have a little bit of good news then to start off. Dave, you have been writing about service sector workers for a long time, and you've been specifically covering people who have been, you know, living on the sort of ragged edge of where the minimum wage is. But this week, you got an intimate look at people who've had their minimum wage raised to $15 an hour, which is, I guess, a king's ransom now.
kingship.
But right. Yeah, it's like, but it actually, you make the case that it actually has really changed a lot of people's lives for the better, just this one move.
You must have misread the article, because it was like post-apocalyptic when I went there.
Oh, really?
After they raised this thing. All the businesses were shuttered, tumbleweeds rolling through town.
Feral cats
and dogs.
Just disease visible in the streets.
Where specifically did you go?
This was SeaTac, Washington.
Okay.
Where the airport is. No, it wasn't a disaster zone, actually. I was joking.
Oh, that's too bad.
But you would have thought it was going to be.
I thought we were about to confirm a lot of people's mythic understanding of what the minimum wage is and does. But instead, we're what? It worked?
Well, it's early. We'll say this. There has not been widespread economic calamity, and a lot of workers' lives have improved for the better. What happened in SeaTac was...
Just to be specific, SeaTac is not Seattle proper, and it's not Tacoma
right.
proper. There's actually an area, I think, that just specifically called SeaTac.
That's right. The airport is SeaTac, but there is a city called SeaTac. It's incorporated. It encompasses the airport and then some. So people do live in SeaTac. I think there's like 28,000 residents of SeaTac. So SEIU, the labor union, a couple of years ago started a ballot initiative to bring a $15 minimum wage to SeaTac. It was very targeted. It was tied to workers who work at the airport and who work in businesses like on the periphery of the airport, so hotels, car rental services, that sort of thing. If you were servicing the airport in some capacity, you were going to get $15 was the idea. And they did it. They pulled it off. And this was a big deal because there's a whole fight for 15 thing going on with fast food workers. This was the first time that they actually succeeded in getting it somewhere. And everybody was kind of like, holy shit. A lot of people that scared a lot of businesses. It scared Seattle because it said like, hey, this 15 thing is coming. You know, you can get on board with it and have a hand in how it plays out. Or you're just going to get steamrolled because people really like this and they're going to vote for a ballot initiative. So SeaTac, they got theirs through the ballot. Seattle, very quickly, that brought labor and businesses to the table and the council. And they hashed out a $15 minimum wage, too. But it's, like, rolled out in phases so that right. The businesses aren't, like, as freaked out about it. So I just wanted to go there and talk to these workers who got raises, like, overnight. Because there was no phase-in in SeaTac. It was, like, you were getting $9 one day, and then the next you were getting $15. So you're talking about 60% raises for a lot of people, which is like, you know, all right, you're not getting rich on $15 an hour in Seattle, right? In fact, you're probably still just kind of eking by. You know, we're talking a salary of around $30,000. You know, maybe you can get a one bedroom or something, but you're not getting wealthy with that money. But again, it's a 60% raise. So it's going to make life a lot easier. So I went to this company called Master Park. They're one of the few companies that right now is actually held to the minimum wage, because all the workers at the airport, the wage has been stayed for them because of a lawsuit. So it's only applying to, like, the estimate is like 1,000 workers in SeaTac.
Right.
So that's where I knew these workers were there. So I went there. The president was super cool, gave me his take on the law, not crazy about it. And then let me interview his workers. And he was like, they're going to tell you they love it, which they did. But it was really, really interesting because I interviewed, I want to say four employees there, four or five. And what every one of them said, I was like, how does this change things for you? And they're like, it's less stress. I no longer am like, feel like I'm pushed up against the wall every week and every month. I have breathing room now. The most interesting guy, his name was Sammy. He immigrated from Afghanistan 11 years ago. He said, how does this change things for you? He said, well, I quit my other full-time job. This guy was working. He was working two full-time jobs and a couple part-time jobs. He was working over 80 hours a week every week. He said, so I just left the other job. Now I work a normal person's job here. And I actually see my children. He's got three kids, two daughters, twins that are 9 and another 10-year-old daughter. He's like, I see my wife and kids. I never used to see them. He said, I also exercise now. You know, he's like, I always wanted to exercise. Didn't have the time to. So he's an interesting case. He went from 80 hours plus down to 40, took a minor pay cut because of that. But because of the huge pay bump he got from 9.55 up to 15 at his one job, he's coming out pretty much even, and he has a life now outside work. And that's all the different workers had similar kinds of stories, maybe not as drastic as that, but the whole message was, I'm no longer, like, terrified of going under, you know, because when you're making that kind of money, your car breaks down, that just throws your world in turmoil, you know. It can send you into, like, brutal debt, you know. It's the smallest thing.
Yeah, you imagine the payday loan industry loathes this $15 an hour.
Yeah, surely, surely. You know, for us, you know, the professional class, we have cushions, you know. I mean, whatever, D.C.'s an expensive place, but you know, you don't know what somebody goes through who's making $9.55 an hour. And so, you know, it's changed things dramatically for them. And the case that's on appeal right now, the decision could drop today. They're going to find out whether all those workers at the airport are eligible for it, too. You know, and I interviewed a guy who works there. He works for a subcontractor that, like, sets the ramps for British Airways and Sun Country and JetBlue, all these huge airlines. They all subcontracted there because it's like, all right, we're going to give it to this little outsourced company. They can deal with, you know, they can deal with giving the workers, you know, lower wages. And so that guy makes $9.50 an hour working at the airport on ramps. Most of us, when we're at the airport, you're looking down at those guys on the plane. You're thinking, like, that's probably a pretty good job, you know. You know, airport jobs traditionally are good jobs. A lot of them are not now, you know, a lot of, because of the subcontracting. They work for sort of these companies you never heard of, even though they're servicing these big airlines that we've all heard of. So I talk with that guy who's waiting on the ruling.
Right.
He's been an activist who wanted this thing so bad. He hasn't had it. He sees the guys at Master Park getting it. And he's like, look, I live with my grandmother. I'm 31 years old because I can't afford my own place. I commute 2 hours each way on public transit. 4 hours a day, this guy is getting to or from SeaTac Airport. And it's because he's making $9.55 an hour, or $9.50 or so. So he's like, I know what I'm going to do if I get that money. I'm going to get an apartment, and I'm going to stop freaking out about the bills I have every month. So it was really fascinating to see, not just the worker's perspective, but in talking with the president of Master Park, who is a really, really nice guy and who clearly had a great relationship with his workers before all of this. They just weren't getting much money, you know?
Yeah.
And he felt he couldn't sustain the raise, but it looks like, you know, he probably can. They're still around, right? It's gotten hard for them. Their labor costs are up. I forget what the figure was. It's well over $1 million a year for a company that isn't huge, right? I mean, they're not a mom and pop shop, but they're not Alaska Airlines either. So right. I sympathized with this guy, especially in the fact that his company's being subjected to a law that so far most companies aren't, you know? And he's competing with self-parking lots up the road that aren't labor-intensive, and since they don't have so few employees, you know, it's all automated, they're not having to swallow these pay increases. So, you know, I really, it was interesting to see his perspective on this and what he said to me. He's like, I don't have a huge problem with 15 an hour. You know, I just wish it was kind of phased in and that it was applied more broadly.
Right, because if he's singled out, right, he's at a competitive disadvantage
exactly,
the other companies who are paying nothing. And, you know, what you could do in these circumstances, if these industries, if $15 an hour really was a threat to the bottom line and it was applied across the industry is just going to raise its prices and customers are going to pay a little more. And I think most people would say, all right, if my parking goes up to, you know, $12 instead of $10 so that people can get paid $15 an hour, that's okay with me. Most customers who are flying on airlines and stuff have the extra money. It's not that big a deal for them. But if only one part of the industry is being subjected to that,
only one company,
right? Then that competitive pressure doesn't exist. That can't happen.
And what these guys did once they had to start paying that, they actually instituted a surcharge on the parking. You know, you pay typically $15 a day to park your car there. They tacked on a $1.99 living wage surcharge, which some people dinged them for. You know, they saw that as kind of like, you know, sort of talking back at the law. You know, whatever. I mean, just pass the cost on. I have no problem with that. You know, if that's what companies are going to do. You know,
what companies have done from time immemorial.
Exactly. Yeah. If you feel charging an extra buck is going to help you recoup those new costs you're taking in to pay your workers a living wage, then go ahead and do it. And it was interesting while I was out there. There's a big Seattle restaurateur named Tom Douglas. He owns a whole bunch of restaurants. I ate in one of them. It was terrific. Because of the Seattle minimum wage, he tried to tack on a 2% surcharge, and he wrote on his blog about it why he was doing it, and people went apeshit, and he like scrapped it in a day because people were just saying, you know, don't put it in our faces like that, and raise your prices if you have to. You know, it was just an interesting situation of a business person who didn't like the law. In that case, I think it was done as a form of protest, kind of. I want you, consumer, to see that you're being charged more because of this law that was passed. But what people were saying in writing back to him, I think, was just, you know, all right, if you got to do it, just add it into the bill discreetly. Don't make a big show about it. So he scrapped his 2% thing because of it. So
just charge 2% more without it.
So I think, you know, look, SeaTac is it's a tiny thing.
The thing is, these are the real costs of these things. You know, you go into a restaurant, you order. It is what it is, and of course, the company's got to make a profit too. You want to make a profit. You want to show growth and maybe build your business out. The people who bring you your food, park your cars, make your coffee, hand you your French fries, that's the real cost of those services. You know?
And
if you think every day you're getting some kind of discount, that's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, a thing is what it is. And the human capital that goes into the making the thing, the distributing the thing, the selling the thing, the maintaining of the thing, that's all – that's true cost. Live with it.
I never really trust the liberal research that says there is no effect to raising the minimum wage at all. There's got to be. And if there isn't, then maybe you're not raising
there's
high
a cost,
enough.
But I think
there has to be some – something's got to give somewhere. You can't double somebody's wage and have zero effect. I mean, yes, the company itself is going to take in less profits, but – things, you know, they're going to move things around. They're going to pass some on off to the customer. Things are going to happen, but probably the world is not going to collapse.
Right. Well, I think you highlighted a company where there's a pretty good relationship between the between management and workers. And obviously, I think there is. I mean, obviously, it's a change. You got to adjust to the change. You know, I think that the way you describe it, I think everyone's sort of like walking hand in hand into whatever this future is. So. I'll root for all of them. I hope they make it work. Thank you.
Oh, well, that was rooting.
I was rooting. Okay.
Fly through SeaTag, you will feel good about parking your car at Master Park.
There you go. Master Park. They're awesome people.
Buy stock.
I'm taking your word for that. We are now a Yelp review for Master Park. Congratulations to us. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. So now we're going to shift gears to maybe a less, happy economic story, but probably one that's just as significant. The TPP, the origin story of so many bad Naughty by Nature jokes, it's the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. It has long loomed in the background of our politics as a thing hanging over it. Not much is known about it because as it is a international trade deal, a lot of details are kept secret. But what we do know is that it has now become quite contentious. Now we have President Obama, who supports TPP, saying, you know, I love Elizabeth Warren. She's my girl. But she's wrong about this. And then Elizabeth Warren's like, no, no, you're the wrong one. Who's right and who's wrong? What's up with TPP?
Well, it's tough to adjudicate those claims when the agreement itself is literally classified. And the level of secrecy that surrounds TPP, just to put it in context, members of Congress can't actually see it.
Why is this kept secret? Why do people keep these trade deals secret?
Well, I mean, I think there is a good faith argument that it's hard to negotiate a trade deal in public, that if you're dealing with a very complex subject, even if it was just one country with another country, so two total countries, they would call this a bilateral deal. There's a lot of different issues to discuss.
Many interested parties.
Yeah.
Who are the interested parties in TPP?
Every single corporation in the United States, Japan, and 10 other nations.
Okay.
And all of the people who work for those corporations.
All right. So these people ought to get along.
Everybody who has an interest in the environment, in labor standards, it is an enormous, enormous category of people. And these deals have a tendency to reset standards by which things that we don't even conventionally think of as being trading standards are applied. So with TPP in particular, there are going to be economic effects on trade in goods and services. There will be some effect there, agricultural goods, cars, that sort of stuff. There will be an impact. The big thing, though, is going to be on the regulatory side because we already have trade agreements with most of these nations.
Right.
There was an agreement called NAFTA that passed in 1993. Canada and Mexico were the other parties to NAFTA. They're also parties to TPP. So there aren't a whole lot of tariffs to get rid of there. So there will be new regulatory standards. And one of the most controversial things for Elizabeth Warren, and we know that she is right about this because this chapter of the deal has actually leaked, is this process called investor-state dispute settlement. And that is basically a process by which a corporation, a foreign corporation or a multinational corporation can say, you know, we don't like this regulation you have passed, in this other country. We believe that it unfairly jeopardizes our investment under the terms of this trade deal. And so we are not going to take you to court in your own courts. We are going to challenge your regulation before an international tribunal. And that process is much more radical than what happens under WTO settlements, where you have one nation arguing with another nation over a trade practice. So under WTO, if the U.S. is upset with China about something—
WTO is the World Trade Organization.
Right, right. Big trade framework established in the 1990s. The United States, you know, Ford Motor Company, for instance, can come to the Obama administration and say, we're really mad about what China's doing, you know, with their tires or whatever. And then the Obama administration, the American government, has got to make a decision that this complaint is in their interest. You can't just have one single company in a single sector challenging the laws of an entire
sovereign nation. Right.
Yes. So that's a really sticky thing, because that power doesn't necessarily have to have anything to do with what's going on.
So just as an example, let's bring it a little closer to home. In the United States, we could pass some sort of environmental regulation, some kind of environmental protection, anti-pollution measure. It could be a federal law, it could be a state law, it could even be a municipal law. And if corporations subject to the TPP arrangement objects to that because it impacts their bottom line in one way or the other, or they're not willing to part with the profits so that we could all drink clean water and live free of poison every fucking day, they could go to this international tribunal and say, I know that the voters in this area express their will about not drowning in poison and not turning their community into the Gowanus Canal, but we really like money. We really like money. International tribunal, help us out, and then they can overrule the plebiscite.
Right.
Is that correct?
They would have to win the case before the—
Right, okay, they'd have to win the case.
So they'd have to win the case, which is not, you know, not obvious, because the case, they would have to find that the environmental regulation that had passed was, you know, was a violation.
I'm sure small-town Joe, who doesn't want to drink poison and live in clouds of dirt, will be, you know, empowered to present his side of the story.
Have a terrific legal team. Right. Well, so that's the issue. The Obama administration has insisted, although they've kept, you know, the terms of the deal secret, that the actual terms of TPP won't allow corporations to challenge, you know, legitimate laws that are passed in the public interest. The problem with that argument is that it's hard to tell what types of regulations are going to be important or necessary going forward. And these treaties are binding well into the future. And we actually saw that with WTO. WTO has all sorts of restrictions on intellectual property terms, what you can do with, you know, other people's stuff that is intellectual property. And it sounds really boring, and in the 1990s, people didn't really think a whole lot about it. But now there are tons and tons of lawsuits going around where patent trolls are just buying up patents so they can sue people with frivolous lawsuits. It's a big tax on the overall economy. And Congress tried to do something about that. They passed a bill called, you know, it was a patent reform law in 2011. That bill is basically nothing. There's basically nothing in it, because members of Congress cited the WTO provisions and said, look, if we do anything to change our patent laws to get rid of all these frivolous lawsuits that are plaguing our economy, we could be in violation of the WTO agreements. And it wasn't even obvious that there was a clear violation there, that we would clearly violate something. And some other country would have had to challenge us in court. But it was obvious that there was a chilling effect on the legislative process here.
That's crazy. Patent trolling is a huge drag on economic growth in the United States.
Yes, it's terrible. And it prevents not just growth, it prevents new startups from doing things. It prevents creative people from doing fun new things that make culture exciting and vibrant. It's a really big deal. And nevertheless, we basically punted on patent reform. And you've actually seen, as a result, you know, Apple owns, you know, bazillions of dollars worth of patents, and so does Samsung, and they're constantly suing each other. These companies used to be really in favor of patent reform. They thought patent trolling was something that was really uncouth. It was something that was not done in polite corporate society. And now the biggest tech companies in the United States are now wasting millions of dollars every year buying these patents and threatening to sue each other with them, and in some cases actually suing them. It's
professional litigants that occasionally make a watch.
Doesn't IBM now hold, like, every year they get like more patents than anybody or something?
Yeah, and it's all, you know, it's nonsense. We should not be granting this many patents. You know, Apple sued Samsung over rounded corners. If you think you've patented the idea of rounded corners, you should have another thing coming for you. But But that's the substance of these lawsuits.
Are they going to sue the Gaudi Cathedral in Barcelona?
And so the worry on TPP, right? Exactly. The worry on TPP is that you know, whatever Obama agrees to put in this pact, he's empowering an awful lot of very powerful corporations to intimidate people going forward, and empowering preventing the United States from being able to regulate in its own interest potentially on things that we don't expect. You know, we don't necessarily see coming yet. There have been other things that have leaked that liberals are even more upset about that seem to be actively bad in the agreement. But I think the investor-state dispute settlement is a big one. It's a major corporate empowerment provision, and it makes pretty clear who is getting the, you know, the sort of the first shot at the goods that are on the table in the agreement.
Is life, if TPP doesn't happen, does life become a disaster?
Well, no. I mean, this is the problem. They say, the proponents of the deal say that, look, this is 40% of the world's economy that's at stake. And that's true. It's mostly true because Japan is involved.
Would 40% of the world's economy just go away, like stop being an economy?
Well, and it's not like they will stop trading with the United States. We have lots of trade with Japan. We trade with Japan all the time about all kinds of things. And it actually seems that the opportunities to open up Japan's market, like to U.S. exports, the two big areas are agriculture and automobiles. The Japanese don't buy a whole lot of American automobiles, and they have generally been able to protect their domestic, the Japanese auto market, by manipulating their currency, devaluing it against the U.S. dollar. So it's not obvious. You know, all this stuff is still secretive. We don't have actual documents, but it's not obvious that there is even going to be a substantive, really opening of the markets that are closed in Japan. So the trading circumstances between the United States and these countries in actual goods, I don't think is going to change dramatically whether TPP passes or doesn't pass. It's the regulatory stuff that's coming in behind it with the agreement that has people really concerned. And you know, you could see, if the terms of the deal are really bad, you could see a flood of imports to the United States that are cheaper. And organized labor is obviously very worried that that'll mean shuttering factories in the United States.
All right. Well, where does it – just briefly, where are things going next with TPP negotiations?
Well, the administration was able to get they were able to get the bill through a trade promotion authority bill, which is sort of a necessary first step to passing TPP in through the Congress, because it bars
it's like
members
the foreplay of foreplay to the larger later sex act.
Yes, exactly. they're just sort of nibbling around the shoulders. although the bill's called Fast Track, so it sort of suggests that the foreplay is not going to be particularly.
Is it ever?
Not going to be a lot of investment.
Is it ever in American politics?
Is there going to be like a TPP porn spoof? Probably not.
No. Right? I don't even know what that would mean.
For all you trade nerds out there, this one's for you.
You know, if there's some kind of like Thomas Pynchon / Joe Stiglitz art house pornographer out there that can actually turn TPP into a porno, we would definitely like
TPP that. Actually probably stands for some weird sex thing that I don't even know about.
Yeah,
actually
it probably does.
check the Urban Dictionary, it probably means something really horrible.
But regardless, the Fast Track bill is cleared committee now.
All right.
But there are like almost no Democratic supporters in the House, so if they can't get the Fast Track bill through the House, they're really screwed. So I think there's going to be a big push from the administration to either round up a whole lot of House Democrats who are in favor of it before the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe comes to the United States to give a speech next week, or a big effort by the administration to tell everybody to shut up about TPP while Shinzo Abe is in town.
All right. Well, moving on to our last topic today, and it's a topic about a topic, to be honest with you. We're getting a little bit meta. Okay.
We're metastasizing?
I don't know if you guys have noticed, but there's a presidential election happening.
Huh. Mm-hmm. I thought that was in 2016.
You thought that. It's not been good the last few weeks of 2016. It's gotten very fatiguing. George Packer, the New Yorker, wrote about it. Here's a quote from George Packer. Quote, "What has happened is that the same things keep happening. The tidal wave of money keeps happening. The trivialization of coverage keeps happening. The issues have remained urgent, but the language of politics stays the same, and it's a dead language." I'll just point out that last night I saw a breaking story on Politico about someone accidentally backing into the bumper of Hillary Clinton's van.
Did anybody get a Pulitzer for that?
I think you get a Pulitzer, like, sir, come pull my knob until something comes out. And then what came out was a 400-word story about a guy who bumped a car that happened to be part of a presidential set of cars that was parked, and it was on Politico.
Did the press corps chase the car?
I don't know. There was like, they got it was like
the Benny Hill music.
They got a quote from like the Secret Service. And it's like, it was infused with this drama. The Secret Service came over, and I'm sure what the Secret Service guy did was like, "Yeah, don't worry about it. It happens. Bump cars, yeah, whatever. Surely this won't become a story."
Or overreacted and was kind of a jerk, but still not a story.
Yes, no one overreacted. No one overreacted. Here's the best thing about this Politico story, because you knew, because they're chasing that Pulitzer, mm-hmm. they couldn't let this go. They actually asked the person who bumped the car who they were going to vote for.
Well, they had do something.
Did they have an answer?
They had not made up their mind. They met a very open-minded New Hampshire person who was just like, it's waiting to see.
Well, then, as a reporter, you just tug that guy's contact away for your right? undecided yeah. stories in another year yeah. or so.
I've seen a couple of really interesting, a week or so ago, just about every GOP hopeful was in New Hampshire. And there were some profiles of the reporters wrote where, like, they just clearly didn't get a story, and they went up there and started, like, talking to people in shoe stores in New Hampshire, like, "So, yeah, how's the shoe business?" And they're like, "Yeah, it's all right. You know, we're trying to sell shoes at the right price."
You know what I'm really bummed about, you guys, is that, like, the national press, and I think this is, like, this is a crime, they have completely dropped the Chipotle story.
Yeah.
I mean, we were learning a lot about Chipotle last week, and now the press has just moved on. Why aren't we hearing more about Chipotle? Because last week it was all about fucking Chipotle.
Well, I'll tell you why, Jason. It's because, I mean, you may have missed this story because it was a real bombshell, but I read in the Wall Street Journal that Hillary Clinton actually flew first class on an airplane recently. That's what I heard.
Yes, I saw that story.
From the Wall Street Journal. That's what I saw.
I saw that story. How dare she? I like the fact the Wall Street Journal. What's funny about this is the Wall Street Journal article that described Hillary Clinton getting on a plane was like so infused with this like class warfare language. It was like obviously just like literally trying to like other Hillary Clinton by painting her as like some rich plutocrat. And I was just like, that's right. Class warriors at the Wall Street fucking Journal taking it to the man. You know, that's what we expect from the Wall Street Journal. An end to capitalism. I appreciate the fact that the Wall Street Journal going full communism.
She probably got two bags of peanuts.
Ooh, I know. Meanwhile, this seat probably cost $500.
So I flew first class by accident once.
What? You're a monster.
Yeah, it was a total accident. I had picked my, like, you know, the front row on some airplane because I wanted to be able to get off quickly. And it just turned out that, like, they had screwed up their, like, seat choosing program, and the first, like, four rows were first class, and they'd let me pick a first class seat. So I was paying, you know, it was like, whatever, $150 flight. But I had the ridiculous first class seat. It was awesome. I mean, I got free booze. I mean, it was like an hour and a half flight. But I just kept being like, I need another beer. I need some champagne. Like, just constantly. It's all free all the time. I got off the plane. I felt terrific.
Really, what happened was Zach was in coach, but told the attendant that he's a veteran, falsely.
Stolen valor.
Wow. So they gave him a vacant first class.
Wow.
So it's like,
yeah, God, how could that be worse? Maybe if I like limped and pretended to be wounded, you know, and have a battle industry, that would be worse.
Can I tell you one other thing about that New Hampshire thing? This is so hilarious to me. So like Bloomberg Politics, Mark Halperin was there.
Great journalist.
He is a multiple Pulitzer winner.
He does a lot of stuff that I can't do, man. He gets these anonymous quotes from people. That, yeah, like, you know, okay. I don't know how to do that.
That's true. I don't know how to do that either. But here's the thing. He was, like, grading people. He was grading all the Republicans on a scorecard. And it was crazy. The grades were so weird because he gave them a grade for style and a grade for substance. And, like, it was really clear.
That, I like, saw that. I that, read like, that. Yeah.
No matter how substantive a person was, it didn't really help their grade.
I saw you. I read it because you tweeted, and I believe your tweet. You said, "Congratulations to everybody who didn't write this."
Right. I'll be doing that a lot this year. I feel. But Sam Wang, Princeton University political scientist and pollster, actually did a regression analysis of like all of Mark Halperin's grades, and he put them on a chart. And he demonstrated that substance almost always hurt people, in that it never really helped push the grade up. In fact, Rand Paul was adjudicated for being too substantive. He was like graded down for being too substantive, and it was really funny because like he had like on the graph the style. There was an arrow pointing up, and the tip of the arrow was style. One tip was style, one tip was substance, and then there was a carrot in the middle of the arrow that demonstrated where people's grades landed between the two. And in the middle of the chart, you'll see people that range from like B plus to D getting Bs. And I'm just like, I don't think that's how grades work. I mean, I went to college and high school, and I would have loved it if that's how grades work. Like every D didn't count against me. That's awesome. But what was amazing is that like there was like, there were five people who got the same overall grade, and it ended up that Donald Trump was not distinguishable from some of the more credible candidates. And it's like, at a very least, you should be able to distinguish Donald Trump from a credible candidate. That's not hard.
It's something. But, you know, there's going to be some great insidery stories about campaigns that I was not going to be able to access that these political reporters are going to be able to knock out. And we just have to get to that stage of the campaign.
Are we? It's like, you're right. You know, how many licks does it take to get to the center of shit? That's 2016. All right. Thanks for joining us today. Joining me today here at So That Happened. And I just want to point out that, like, our commitment to you guys is that we're going to try our best to not cover 2016 so heavily. We did a fine job today talking about real people, real issues, real politics, and real concerns of real human Americans. But it'll be unavoidable at times, and we apologize for contributing to the shit. Anyway, joining me today,
Zach Carter.
And
Dave Jamieson.
And I'm Jason Linkins, editor of Eat the Press. You can follow Zach Carter on Twitter at Zach D. Carter. It's ZachDCarter. You can follow Dave Jamieson on Twitter or whatever the fuck your Twitter handle is.
Jamieson.
That's it.
J-A-M-I-E-S-O-N. Not like the whiskey. People think I'm the whiskey. They tweet at me like I'm the whiskey.
I look at you and I think you are
I'm
whiskey.
I'm full of whiskey sometimes, but
full of whiskey.
Not the whiskey.
You are?
Full of whiskey right now. And I'm Jason Linkins. You can follow me at Deceiver. That's DCEIVER. I'm going to leave the studio like in a rush because there's another podcast happening apparently. So, toodaloo, thanks for being with us. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta and Adriana Ucero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, I was joined by Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Dave Jamieson. So That Happened is available on your iTunes, so please check us out in the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post whole family of podcasts. Subscribe to the ones you like and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, go ahead, send us an email and send that email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, we thank you so much for listening. We miss you already.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at yoquierodineropodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.